In today's podcast, we'll be exploring how the Middle East was invented. What's going on, everyone? It's your favorite history nerd, Ramblings of a Sikh, and I'm back with yet another exciting podcast episode. And this time, I'm joined by historian Dr. Julien Meyer Crusoe, author of Inventing the Middle East, Britain and the Persian Gulf in the Age of Global Imperialism. Most of us may be vaguely aware of the Middle East due to more recent events such as the Gulf War of the early 1990s, the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, or the Arab Spring of the 2010s. But we'll go beyond that today, exploring the historical context of the region and also uncover the changing relationship between Britain and the Persian Gulf throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, how Britain's policies differed from those towards other colonies, how the Middle East acted as a buffer zone for British imperial interest in India, and how Japanese cultured pearls almost destroyed the East India Company's farming and trading of pearls in the Middle East. We'll also explore the long history of oil in the region, how the British Indian Army was pivotal to maintaining Britain's imperialism in the Middle East, amongst other questions. So join us today in discovering how Britain's imperial policies and practices have had a long-lasting impact on the political, geographic, and economic landscape of the Middle East. As always, before we get started, we always like to find out a little bit more about our guests. So could we please just get a brief introduction as to who you are?
Well, so as you said, I'm a historian of the British Empire and the Middle East in the 19th and 20th century. I'm currently attached to the University of Warwick in the History Department as a postdoctoral fellow, where I'm also doing a bit of teaching. And in general, my interests are in the history of the British Empire, the history of globalization and global commodities in the 19th century, and maritime spaces. So I guess also a bit of environmental history.
Wow. Okay. One question that I always kind of gets my curiosity is what, like, before this book, before everything, what initially sparked your interest even approaching kind of history as a field? Or like, as in, like, was there a particular incident? Was there kind of like a family member who really kind of inspired you to look into your history? Like, what was it that initially, I guess, kind of sparked that flame?
So I grew up in a family with a lot of academics and historians. So obviously, you know, at dinner or at lunch, we spoke a lot about history. So I guess this had this had an impact on me. And then, you know, when it came to studying at university, I went on to study history and geography. And I guess also this is where geography also had a really strong impact on my work as a historian. And I particularly studied the work of the French Annales School, with historians who approach history with a long durée perspective, also with a strong emphasis on the environment. I particularly enjoy Fernand Braudel, The Mediterranean, which I still look as a big model for my work and what I try to do for the Persian Gulf. And so I think it's a combination of this interest in geography, history, and when the opportunity came to embark on doing a PhD, I was very lucky to do so and get funding. And then obviously I came to the UK, as it's a great place for British history, and Warwick has been a great place for me to develop, you know, various projects.
No, that is wonderful. I just love to find out kind of what sparks that, because I had a grandma that was very just interested in history, and I think it just rubbed off. So it's always interesting to see how others kind
definitely
of end up in this field. Coming right up to kind of recently, I guess, with your most recent book, Inventing the Middle East, Britain and the Persian Gulf in the Age of Global Imperialism, what inspired you to write that then? Like, what was the kind of, I guess, the light bulb moment that you thought, I'm like, this is my project, this is what I want to do?
When I approached, I'd say, the history of the British Empire in the 19th century, or the history of the Middle East in the 19th and 20th century, like everyone, what I noted is that there are shelves of libraries which are filled with books that discuss the history of the Middle East as a creation of the 20th century. You know, a space created in the aftermath of the First World War, on the tables of the peace conference with diplomats drawing, you know, maps and lines. Obviously, oil played a big role in this. So there's this big narrative, and I became familiar with it. But what sparked my interest is I discovered that around 1900, there are a cluster of evocation just of the term Middle East for the first time. This is the first time you find at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the term Middle East used by journalists, for example, by political strategist figure. And that really sparked my interest because they all refer to the Middle East as a creation of British India, of the British Empire in India, and as a creation of the 19th century, and the Middle East being this vast buffer zone on the western flank of India. And they define it as a sort of borderless space extending from Egypt to Afghanistan and encompassing the Arabian Peninsula, the Persian Gulf. And what all these writings and early evocations describe is the process that took place in the 19th century, and that the imperialism of British India shaped this space for the purpose of defending the British Empire in India, but also connecting it to various bases, and we can discuss that later. So that really sparked my interest. And what I wanted to show is that there was an earlier phase of British imperialism that pre-shaped the Middle East and also maybe give it another cluster of definition that slightly differ from the one we have for the 20th century. And so from this, I embark in sort of, retrospectively reconstructing this history of the 19th century.
No, definitely. I found it really interesting because obviously as someone who's quite focused on British history and the British Raj and kind of its impact on India and in particular Sikhs, it was connecting dots in places that I wasn't necessarily aware of. So just kind of how the Middle East is being treated whilst the British are kind of cementing their power in India, and how there are completely different strategies that are being deployed in these different areas in order to kind of almost get to the same conclusion. Again, it piqued me my curiosity even further to then actually question, like, why are they behaving differently in these different areas, which I'm sure we will get into as we continue. So then, in terms of these initial journalists and other individuals who are first using the term Middle East, I'm assuming these people are in some way, shape or form connected to some type of European imperial power. Like, I can't assume they're necessarily coming from, like, what I mean by that is, and I can't assume necessarily, say, someone in the Middle East or someone in India necessarily referring to that area with that term. So are they using that initially to, I guess they're almost kind of demarcating the areas that are outside of their control, or kind of what I guess what I'm actually asking is, what is or how is that initial term being used in those first phases?
So you're right. So it's used by figures who for some of them have been posted in India. So the first person credited to have used the term Middle East in reference to this buffer zone is Gordon, who was posted in India who was in the administration of the Raj. Then Valentine Shirol, who's a British journalist, traveled extensively in the Middle East. And then you've got Afan Mahan, so the American naval strategist. So, and they referred really to the term as, because there is the need to sort of like describe and define the area where the British have established their rule and an informal rule throughout the 19th century, and also the need to refer to this zone which is protecting the Raj on its western flank. So obviously in the 19th century and early 20th century, in terms of, let's say, the history of geography, there is a tendency to start, naming big regions where we in Europe and etc. So it's part, obviously, of this process of putting names on map to describe various geographical and political and strategical processes. So the Middle East is part of this. But what I found really fascinating is the term Middle East is created to describe retrospectively a century of British imperialism, West Asia.
Okay, interest. Just kind of then coming back to the actual role that British imperialism is playing in the Middle East, how does Britain's involvement in the Gulf and in the Arabian Peninsula, in that whole area, change throughout the 19th and 20th centuries? And how is that beneficial to their political or economic or kind of whatever power that they're trying to gain from this?
I think the first thing to say is, so when we think about the British Empire, the Middle East, everything starts in the Gulf and everything ends then in the Gulf in 1971. That's the last phase of decolonization in the Middle East. And the second thing to say is that the British had been present in the Gulf since the 17th century with the East India Company and factories and agencies and trading outposts that were spread out either mostly on the Persian side of the Gulf, but also in Ottoman Iraq. But things changed really in the late 18th, early 19th century with the Napoleonic Wars and the arrival of the French expedition in Egypt in 1798. So that's something that I emphasize in the book, is that for me, to envisage the creation of the Middle East, it's not so much at 1914 that we need to look at, but maybe at 1798. Because the fact that Napoleon was present in Egypt and occupying Egypt, even if it ended up in a disaster, it for the first time showed the British that their the possessions of the East India Companies and the territories the East India Company had conquered were at the mercy of a potential invasion. And there's this great fear that obviously the French play with, but that the French might invade India from Egypt through like complicated routes. It's actually when you look at the letter Napoleon had been given by the French government at the time, so the directory, the aim of the occupation of Egypt was to disturb really the British in the Mediterranean outpost, but also potentially in the position they had in India. And that triggers a massive fear. And then suddenly it's about how do we protect the British Empire in India? So it all goes back to the French.
I love that. So like, just to kind of summarize, and I know this is, in some ways, it kind of removes a lot of the nuance, but to some degree, the Middle East is created to a large extent simply to protect British interests in India.
Yeah, I think that's the argument of my book. But I think what also I found really fascinating when you look at the way the British perceived their space, whether we're talking about travelers, we're talking about, you know, diplomats or employees and official of the East India Company and later of the British administration in India, or when you look at the project of, steam enthusiasts, for example, or that, you know, people wanted to invest capital in railways in the Ottoman Iraq, is that the Middle East is not only this space that will, or this vast region that will defend potentially and protect the British Empire in India, but it's also a space that will connect British India with Europe, with the Mediterranean, and with London. So it's a parallel route to Suez with a lot of images and a vast imaginary attached to it. It's a place where also the British, by creating railways and steams that will enable connections and through like complex routes, where the British can recreate some of the prosperity of the empires that have preceded them in the area. So it's about recreating some of the splendor of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, or the irrigation techniques and, you know, the lush and fertile past of Mesopotamia, of ancient Mesopotamia. So it's very complex. It's not just about there. It's also about, a sort of an imaginary of a place that can renew with a vast prosperity.
So it's almost kind of, I guess, there's some parallels that jump out to me. So for argument's sake, with some of the early kind of descriptions of India, is very much kind of painted as this place where you can go and become rich and famous and get all of this money and come back and live a splendid life. So I guess, and again, a lot of this is built off the back of an imaginary kind of Orientalism, even of India, of it being this whatever kind of crazy dreamlike space. So I'm assuming it's very much a similar thing with the Middle East, where they're painting the Middle East to be this. It's almost like going back to its ancient history and being like, well, actually, if they had ancient gardens of Babylon, like, we are going to try and almost like recreate that, or like re-establish ourselves as a empire that kind of is on parallel. Or is that perhaps drawing conclusions too far?
No, you're completely right. So this is what the book looks at. These Orientalist representation. All of archaeology had in this, you know, was layout sort of, you know, unearthing the remains of these great civilizations, these great kingdoms. And where Nineveh and all the cities which have disappeared, or the civilization which are gone, the Assyrians, the Mesopotamians, where Alexander the Great even has failed, the British will succeed. And the British see themselves as the sort of natural heirs. And from there, in sort of what I found really fascinating is that there's this idea that if the British Empire succeeds in restoring this ancient prosperity, it will be immortal. And the rule is then, you know, gonna last forever.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of then kind of what's happening, obviously there are real people on the floor, kind of in the area that are being affected by all of these policies, and most of them do not necessarily have a say or an influence on what's happening. But what is the impact of Britain's interest in this area and its kind of imperialism that is being enforced upon it during the 19th to 20th century? Like, what impact does that have on the local populations in the area, and how do they respond?
Great question. It's not easy because we don't have a lot of sources, or shall I say, we've got no sources. It's all about, you know, trying to retrace this through British sources, and at least that's what I've tried to do. So I think the first thing to say is, in the early 19th century, late 18th century, there is a whole discourse coming from British India, describing the populations of the Gulf as pirates. And just, you know, whether we talk about, for example, the Kazimi of Ras El Khaimah, so the city guarding the Strait of Hormuz, or even in general, all the population of the Arabian coast. And they are categorized as pirates, accusing to attack the ships of the East India Company, be constantly at war. So there is this whole discourse. And it shows in the end how little the British knew and understood about local populations, obviously. And this discourse became a justification for the intervention of the East India Company twice against the populations of the Gulf, especially Ras El Khaimah, but other small port cities that were allied. And, you know, these cities were bombed. The fleets were destroyed. So a lot of violence unfolded. And it marked really the beginning of, a sort of like gunboat violent imperialism in the Gulf. And then the second thing, what I show in the book, the British, to try to, maintain their influence in the area, but at low cost. Because there was the story, right? Everything at low cost, it's in direct rule, informal empire. Develop what I've called a political economy around the pearls and the dates. So two commodities that enjoyed a boom in the whole 19th century. And so around these two commodities, the British really developed an empire of the pearl and an empire of the date. And this obviously has a huge impact because the populations of the Gulf then are involved in date growing and date harvesting, and in pearl also fishing. And this required a lot of slave labor coming from especially East Africa and the whole like slave trade network of the Indian Ocean. So no wonder then the British sort of like turned a blind eye, or were maybe a little bit less active than they pretended to be into trying to put an end to the slave trade, because the slave trade was really fueling the globalization of these two commodities and helping create, you know, an area of like supposedly peace and prosperity with the populations of the Gulf not involved in piracy anymore and warfare, but involved in the trade of these two commodities.
But again, it's creating the excuse though, isn't it? It's saying that these local inhabitants are the troublemakers, they're the pirates. That gives them the British Empire the excuse to bomb them and basically do what they want. And then
Bombay, absolutely bomb them. Burn
it's
them.
It's a similar thing with kind of what happens with when the British are in India before they try and annex Punjab. They actually blame the Lahore state for sending over their army into past the Sutlej and into British territory, which from all intensive research has shown isn't true. But again, it's the excuse to basically create the problem that we can all now all of a sudden resolve. And so it's very interesting to hear the parallels between what they're doing in India and what they're doing in the Middle East. And again, it's the same old British imperialism that I think a lot of us have become more aware of in more recent times. But anyways, moving then on, I think one thing that I really found interesting and personally it was the title of your book that really caught my eye, because it is very provocative in the sense that you're like, well, invented the Middle East, like what does that mean? So in terms of the concept of inventing the Middle East, I know we've discussed it earlier about kind of historically when it kind of first came about, but what is it that is being created and sustained, and how does that change from the initial usage of the term until, say, kind of more recent period of time?
Yeah, so as I said, we've got a first cluster of definitions, and it's not then the definition that appears after 1914, 1918, of, you know, the Middle East being a sort of mosaic of territories with different legal and administrative statuses, and obviously the French and British mandates. So it's another definition. It's also another state, region where you do not have like borders like delineated like with such precisions. Obviously, so I think that's the main difference, and that's what I wanted to show. And in the 19th century, I mean, let's start with the beginning of the story. So in the late 18th century, when the British arrive in the Gulf, because that's where the story starts, it's a region which is under the very, very, very loose control of the Ottoman Empire, but which has sort of like given up on controlling these territories. You've got Qajar Persia, which is not really involved directly in the maritime affairs of the Gulf. And the British will sign then a lot of treaties with the Qajars at the beginning of the 19th century. So throughout the 19th century, the British deal with different actors, but what they succeed in is creating a whole area of sort of like indirect, informal rule. So we're talking about Egypt. Obviously, in Egypt from 1882, the occupation of Egypt is much more direct, and then it becomes a protectorate, obviously. But it's a vast zone of indirect and informal rule where the British basically exert their influence throughout various means. So whether we are talking about steam project, mapping and surveying expeditions, the gunboats and the warships being sent to bomb people. But this region in the end finds, let's say, a type of unity, or it becomes a unit, because its fundamental definition is, throughout this area, the function is to defend the British Empire in India.
Were there any initial cases of anti-imperialist activity from any of the population? Was there any activity to kick the British out initially, or does that occur much later on?
Well, I guess you can see the said-to-be pirates of the late 18th, 19th century, so the Kazimi, as resisting British imperialism and resisting also the economic presence of the East India Company. And interestingly, a couple of historians from the Gulf, they see this sort of like this resistance and this moment as key in the creation of an Arab nationalism in the Gulf. So that's quite interesting. But overall, there is a resistance, or there are multiple forms of resistance. So I guess I'll cite like two examples. The first one is in the late 19th century, there is, an outburst of arms trafficking in the Gulf. So the Gulf becomes a hub for an illegal trade in arms and ammunition, fueling the Northwest Frontier Rebellion. So the arms sort of like circulate in transit, like from Muscat and Bahrain throughout Persia or Baluchistan to fuel. And the local population are really heavily involved in this trade and make money out of it. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, despite the attempt of the British to create a Pax Britannica in the area and control in the sort of like what I called in the book the sort of like cracks, you know, of the network, this illegal trade happens. And the second thing is really interesting also, in the interwar period, after the invention of cultured pearls in Japan, and when cultured pearls, which are cultivated, right, not natural pearls, start to flood the markets, there is obviously a decline in the trade of natural pearls. So that creates a lot of sort of economic distress in the Gulf, because pearl fisheries were really the main, you know, economic sector for the population of the Gulf. And there are some really violent outbursts of violence, even called by the British like pearl riots. So I guess the local population sort of react against, you know, a century of policy by the British of really emphasizing the pearl fisheries as the place from which the Pax Britannica could have been created. And when the trade falls apart, in some ways, the imperial structure is shaken.
Crazy. It's nuts to see how these things like cultured pearls coming up in Japan has a knock-on effect in the Middle East, and then basically helps to pull the rug out from underneath the British imperialism in that area. Yeah, it's just nuts. However, coming, just continuing with our line of questioning then, and again, this probably is a question more out of my ignorance of this particular area than anything, but how are other imperialist players jostling with Britain in this area during this period? Like, I can't imagine Britain kind of just turns up in the Gulf and no other European imperial power kind of ignores it. You did mention earlier how the French Napoleon was in Egypt at one point, and this sends kind of a scare through the British, and hence kind of informs their policies moving forward with the Middle East. But what are other European imperial powers doing during this period of time whilst the British are obviously focusing on the Gulf and other areas?
Even like if we go back to the 18th century, first the British have to contend with the Dutch and the Dutch East India Company. And the Dutch had a couple also of trading outposts, like the Gulf was part of the Dutch East India Company trading network. And I guess it's a succession of, imperial rivalries. The French are really important because there was this dream of Napoleon, not only of, you know, potentially sort of threatening the British in India, but being the new Alexander who could create recreate a French Alexander style empire in the Orient. So there's this Oriental dream of Napoleon, and he threatens the British, you know, in Persia, also in the Arabian Peninsula, etc. And of course, there's the famous sort of rapprochement with Tipu Sultan, well, half legendary and half true. And then the Russians are really important. So the Gulf is part of the great game. Strategical rivalry between Britain and Russia. But I guess the most important and threatening rivals are the Germans in the late 19th, early 20th century. And the British are really scared of, you know, the diplomatic ties that are created from the late 19th century between Germany and the Ottoman Empire, and the project of the Baghdad Bahn, so the railway that was supposed to connect Constantinople with Baghdad, and the fear that, you know, the Germans are really active in the Ottoman Empire, with a lot of capital being invested throughout the Ottoman Empire, and that potentially they could reach the Gulf. So there's a lot of discourse going on from British officials posted in the Gulf who's reporting on German activities, not only in Ottoman Iraq, but even in the Gulf, because you've got also some, you know, German diplomats that start traveling around. So there's a lot of fear and suspicion. But what I found really fascinating is that these fears these reports, etc., sort of continuously trigger more British interventionism in the Gulf. So new treaties are signed with the local rulers of the Gulf in the late 19th century, precisely because the British are worried that the Germans will get a foothold in the Gulf and will threaten their domination on the western flank of India. And from there, everything becomes possible.
I've never, ever heard about German investment and intervention in the Middle East and how that then connects to the British. So you've definitely caught my curiosity. Besides Germany investing capital and creating perhaps trade treaties and other agreements with people in the area, how else do they cooperate that really makes Britain so nervous? Is it the fact that they're apprehensive of like Germany taking over the area, or like is it because they have an informal rule? Like, what is it in particular that really scares them about the Germans?
I think you've got the answer in your question. It's really two things. It's German like really proactive policy in the Ottoman Empire. So Kaiser Wilhelm like traveled to Constantinople, even travels to Jerusalem at some point. So you know, once it feels like the German really are getting a foothold in the Gulf, and they're really active, yes, in investing capital. And the project, this really big project of a German railway coming up to the shores of the Gulf, that's fundamental, because once you've got a railway, you can have troops, you can have goods, and you can have people coming. And then the second thing is, yes, in the end, as I've said, the British had created an informal imperial structure. So it was about treaties. It was about ships patrolling. It was about a political economy around pearls and dates, but it was not a direct military occupation and domination. Therefore, everything seems a bit fragile. And this is where, as I said, it gets really interesting, because when the British feel threatened, then they feel the need to reinforce their legal and political status. So signing new treaties, which look like protectorates. So just like what's happening in Egypt in 1882, and then at the eve of the First World War, well, the British start in the late 19th, early 20th century signing new treaties with the Arabian rulers of the Gulf, which look like really, treaties creating protectorates.
It's just fascinating, this conversation. One thing that I can't remember which chapter it was in now in the book, but there is a chapter that deals with kind of, it discusses the role of Britain's imperialism in the Middle East, in particular the use of the British Indian Army and how that's pivotal to some of the way the British imperialism is being, I guess, used or worked out at that point. How do the British Indian Army come into this equation, and what role do they play?
They play a big role, especially in the early 19th century with the two expeditions against Ras El Khaimah and other port cities in the Gulf. So the troops are sent from Bombay. It's mostly British Indian troops, and they intervene twice. And it's probably the largest, deployment of troops in the history of the Middle East then until the First World War. And then there's another like quite striking episode, but that brings us really to the First World War. Just after the declaration of war of Germany and the Ottoman Empire, immediately the British send from India a lot of troops to take possession and occupy and defend military Abadan, the refinery of Abadan. So they send a lot of troops so that they assure that the very strategic, oil outposts are guarded and protected in the context of the declaration of war. Obviously, during the First World War, British Indian troops play a huge role in the fight against the Ottoman Empire and ultimately the occupation of Ottoman Iraq. And then the general British war effort in the Middle East that will lead to the occupation of most of the region from 1917 and obviously after 1918.
Considering the British Indian Army had such a pivotal role to play in that area, and especially during kind of a time of war, and also being used in some sense as they're in a foreign invading force, like, to be quite frank, how are the British Indian Army, perhaps necessarily not now, I don't know, but how were they perceived by the locals over time, and especially considering they're there as an occupation? They're not necessarily there as, like, they're not there on friendly terms. So how, I guess, what was the cultural impact of that occurring, and how do people nowadays in that area perhaps perceive the events that have happened?
It's a great question. As I said, it's really hard in some ways to come up with an answer because of the lack of sources. As we've discussed, yes, the British Indian Army was present throughout the 19th century. One thing I forgot to mention is also that they accompanied and sometimes led the surveys that were conducted in the area. So the whole surveying and mapping effort, the British Indian Army contributed to it. Really in the narrative about, yes, the Gulf in the 19th century that then has been created, you know, by the new, the United Arab Emirates, or in the United Arab Emirates or other nation states in the Gulf. It's really about the violence of the British Empire in India and how it unleashes, especially in the early 19th century. Definitely not on really friendly terms. It was about, you know, it's a story about war, imperialism, occupation, and exploitation.
No, definitely. I can well imagine. You mentioned briefly the role of oil and how that was very pivotal to why imperialist interests were kind of focused in that area. I guess a lot of people listening to this may have a more modern view of the area and oil, and especially with the American invasions that have taken place over the last few decades and all of the atrocities that have gone along with that. But what is the role of oil? How does that change over time? And I guess to some degrees, how hasn't that also changed over time? Because it seems like, to a degree, history is repeating itself.
So I think the first thing to say is, again, we have, as you said, a vision of oil which is really heavily 20th century focused. So it's mostly about the aftermath of the Second World War and American investments and, you know, the discovery of the gigantic, especially, I mean, oil fields, not only in Iraq, but Saudi Arabia, right? And that's kind of my what my new project is and what I'm interested about is that there is an early history of oil. So the oil is discovered in the Middle East by the company that will ultimately become, I mean, the British Petroleum, that was called at the time the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, is discovered in 1908 in Persia. So there is really an early history after years of searching, 7 years, because a British gentleman called William Knox Darcy got given a concession by the Qajar ruler at the time, William Knox Darcy. So after 7 years of searching and unsuccessfully for oil in the Qajar Empire, the British managed to strike oil in southwest Persia in 1908. What I think is really fascinating is that so this oil company, which is created slowly as oil fields are discovered in the Middle East by the British, acts in some ways just like the East India Company, or a bit like the East India Company was acting. So it's a proxy of the British government, creating influence, creating, you know, an informal type of empire. You've got the oil fields, you've got the installation, and before you had the factories of the East India Company. And they really work hands in hand with the British government, helping them negotiate concessions, helping them build the infrastructures, etc. and etc. Sometimes even investing or helping the company, you know, stay afloat in terms of capital. So you're right, history is repeating itself. And what I find fascinating is that, yes, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company is, in some ways, another big company, just like the East India Company, acting on behalf of the British government in the area.
What, like, considering there's been close to, if not more than 100 years of intervention by European powers in the area, what are, like, local attitudes like to, like, things like the Anglo-Persian Oil Company? Like, as in, are modern sensibilities really that bothered about what's happened in the past? Or have we got now to a point where kind of the history of the past is only kind of known to those who have bothered to go and study it, because it's just like it's almost out of like living memory, if that makes sense. So, like, what I guess kind of what's going on in the area now, considering how things to some degree are still very similar, like it's still like European powers in whatever way we want to define it. But yeah, what do you think of what's happening? What do other people from that area think?
I guess what I've tried to do in the book, even if I, you know, do not draw directly conclusion, is to say the legacies we live with of, you know, centuries of British interventions, we can trace them back to the 19th century and to the late 18th century. So maybe no one remembers the intervention against Ras El Khaimah, but in some ways, the intervention against Ras El Khaimah is then what triggers later the creation of the British mandates and how borders were drawn artificially in the area. How you know, an early oil discovery then triggers the whole history of oil and the sort of like also role of the British Empire then, you know, into you know, the importance of like fossil fuels and climate change in general, and also you know, how the British also started from the 19th century sort of co-opting local rulers and creating artificially, just as they were doing in India, right, with the indirect co-opting local dynasties and putting in place, you know, the rulers they had chosen. That's what they do in the interwar period with the Hashemites, for example. But that's what they were doing earlier on with the local rulers in the Gulf. So this is really what I'm interested in is... We do live with the legacies of centuries of intervention, and this is, you know, visible everywhere in the Middle East. But what I try to show is definitely the interwar period has its importance, but like even before. So the strategies that were deployed from 1918 were already in some ways deployed in the 19th century. So we need to assess British imperialism really over the a longer period.
So what lessons do you think could be learned from the history of British imperialism's role in the Persian Gulf, especially for contemporary Middle Eastern politics?
I guess, once again, it's, yeah, I mean, what you said in your question, it's really hard because we tend to forget about the past, but really what the book is about into showing, yeah, so the Middle East is this space artificially created in the aftermath of the First World War. But there is an early history to this, and that we need to take it into account to fully understand the legacies and every British interventions in the Middle East and what they did and created. Everything starts in the Gulf in the 18th century, and everything ends with the Gulf in 1971. Because let's not forget, and this is what Suez shows, is that the British didn't want it to leave. And they certainly, it took them then after 20 more years to actually depart in 1971. That's the end of British rule in the Middle East in some ways. So from starting with the East India Company in the 17th century, and then gradually, of course, the East India Company becoming a political power to 1971. But as I said, the strategies and the really the impact of British rule starts much earlier than 1918. And this is what I've hoped to show.
Congratulations, you made it to the end of another exciting podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed learning about the fascinating history of how the Middle East was invented. But before we wrap up, I want to give a quick shout out to our incredible patrons Neil B, Hernan Pazadan, Jazz Dylan, Gurpreet Singh, Gurdeep Bath, Himmat Singh Khalsa, Anish Mand, Ramnik Kaur, Mani Singh, Rav Singh, Ramnik Kaur, Amardeep Basi, Yasmin Jaswal, and Gagan Singh. At the same time, I also want to give a shout out to our YouTube members Jazz S, N Singh, Gavin Shergill, RB, Gary Parmar, GS, Gurpreet Tanjal, Radhaji Kaur, Hunter Hill, Amanveer Mandir and Homejeet Singh. If you love this episode and want to support the work we're doing, please consider becoming a Patreon or YouTube member. You'll get access to exclusive content and rewards and help us continue to create awesome episodes. Thank you all for tuning in, and we can't wait to see you again in our next episode.